from this episode.
An aircraft can actually fly with multiple things that don't work or that are quote-unquote deferred. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that a lot of people may not want to hear, but the aircraft is designed to fly with multiple systems, in most cases, inoperative. The reason for this is, you know, again, going back to the beginning, we have so many systems that are designed with backups and multiple layers of redundancy that the aircraft is capable of flying on sometimes with maybe just one system operative and two or three systems in op.
This is Flying Smarter, the podcast that explores the fascinating world of air travel to help you become a smarter and savvier traveler. While flying can be stressful and frustrating, the world of commercial aviation is also incredibly intriguing. Flying Smarter delves into the miraculous and often misunderstood realm of air travel by sharing stories and experiences, looking at how things work in the air travel industry, and providing tips and advice for your next trip. Your host, Andrew, is here to answer your questions about flying and explore different aspects of the air travel experience to make you a better informed and better prepared traveler for your next flight.
And welcome to episode 57 of Flying Smarter. I'm Andrew, and I'm your host. Today's episode contains the second part of my interview with aircraft maintenance technician and professor of aviation maintenance, Brian Bermudez. In the last episode, we talked about things like what common maintenance issues occur with airliners, how often they go into maintenance, and how maintenance works at outstations. And today, we're continuing our chat with much more about airline maintenance. Before that, though, I'm going to take a look at airline loyalty point expiry, looking at the different types of policies out there for your points and miles, and how you can prevent them from expiring and going to waste. Now, let's get started. Do airline loyalty points and miles expire? If you've listened to the podcast for a while, you'll know that I occasionally like to cover points and miles. Loyalty program points can be very powerful tools in your travels, saving you lots of money and unlocking some fantastic experiences. So if you're collecting points and miles in the hopes of using them, you'll want to be well aware of the rules surrounding their expiry. Now, the answer to the question of whether points and miles expire is that it depends on the program. Each program has its own policy, but they typically fall into one of three categories: points that don't expire, points that expire but that you can prevent from expiring through points activity, and points that expire with no way of extending the expiry date. Let's take a look at each type. The best expiration policies are obviously the ones where your points and miles just don't expire. This is the case for many airlines in the United States, including Delta, Hawaiian, JetBlue, Southwest, and United. Some airlines also have points and miles that expire, but the expiry is waived under certain circumstances. For example, American Airlines Advantage miles expire 24 months after the account's last activity, but they do not expire for certain credit card holders and for members under the age of 21. Lufthansa's Miles & More points also don't expire if you have elite status or meet certain requirements with their co-branded credit card. Unfortunately, though, programs with never-expiring points are in the minority, and most airline loyalty points do have some sort of expiry date. That being said, with many airlines, your points and miles won't expire as long as you keep your account active in some way, and this is the second type of expiry policy. Another way of looking at this is that your points will expire after a certain period of inactivity, but you can extend that period by keeping your account active through what the airline considers to be qualifying activity. The timelines and activity requirements vary by program. For example, Air Canada Aeroplan points expire after 18 months of inactivity, Frontier miles expire after 12 months without activity, and Air France KLM Flying Blue points expire after 24 months of inactivity. With programs like these, you have to have certain types of activity on your account if you want to prevent your points and miles from expiring. Unsurprisingly, what is considered to be qualifying activity varies between airlines. Let's take a look at the three examples that I just used, looking at the policies as of the time of publication of this episode. With Air Canada's Aeroplan program, you can prevent your points from expiring by earning points through flying, hotel and car rental bookings, or shopping through the Aeroplan shopping portal, or at a partner retailer. Point redemptions are also considered qualifying activity, whether you use them for booking flights, hotels, or car rentals, redeeming them for gift cards, or using them to purchase extras like in-flight Wi-Fi. And finally, you can donate your points, transfer them to someone else, or convert points from another loyalty program into Aeroplan points. Moving on to Frontier Airlines, you can keep your Frontier miles active by earning miles through flying, spending on their co-branded credit card, or earning through an earn partner. Redeeming your points in any way also qualifies as activity, and the third option is to donate your miles. With Air France KLM flying blue points, your points will expire after 2 years. That is unless you take an eligible flight with Air France KLM or a partner airline, you have silver, gold, or platinum status in their program, or you make a purchase with an eligible partner bank card. Now, I chose these three programs to give you an idea of some of the activities that qualify to keep your points from expiring, and I think they offer a broad overview of the common options out there, but as you can see, it varies by airline. Now, the final category is airline loyalty programs where the points have an expiry date and there's no way of extending it. Many airlines in Asia are like this, with Japan Airlines, All Nippon Airways, Air India, EVA Air, China Airlines, and Singapore Airlines. Points expire 36 months after they were earned, or after 18 months of inactivity in the case of Singapore Airlines. There is no way to prevent the points from expiring after the 36 months. With Korean Air's and Asiana's programs, points expire after 10 years, although certain members of Asiana's loyalty program who have status get an extra 2 years on top of that. Now, as you can see, there are big differences between the expiry policies of different airlines. If you're collecting points and miles with the intention of using them later, it's important to know if and when they will expire. If the program allows you to keep your account active to prevent your points from expiring, you should plan to make sure that you meet the qualifying activity requirements. Sometimes this can be super simple, like making a purchase through a shopping portal or by transferring points. And the good news is that the airline loyalty program websites typically make it pretty easy to find the basics of their expiry policy, either just by going through their website or through a simple Google search. I really enjoy bringing Flying Smarter to you. You're likely well aware that I'm super passionate and interested in the world of air travel, and I love sharing it all with you. If you haven't done so already, leaving a nice review for the podcast is an easy and free way to help me out with growing and improving the show. If you enjoy listening to Flying Smarter and have been able to learn from the podcast, please help me out by leaving a 5-star review on your podcast app. Not only does it help grow the audience, but it also helps show potential guests that the show is worth their time and convince them to come share their knowledge and insights. If you're listening on a platform that allows you to do so, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, I would really appreciate it if you could take a moment to leave a positive rating or review for the podcast. Thank you so much for your support. Did you know that you can buy many onboard airline snacks at home? Some products are fairly easy to find, like the famous Biscoff cookies served on many airlines, and the That's It fruit snacks served on some United flights. But some other snacks in the skies are a bit harder to find. For example, there's a company called King Nut that sells the United Airlines Savory Snack Mix and Southwest Snack Mix online, both in the same packaging that you'll find in the air. If you're looking for American Airlines' first-class nut mix, they're sold online by the Great Nut Supply Company. If you want to learn more and check out some of these suppliers, I've published a post on the Insight section of the Flying Smarter website about where you can find certain onboard snacks. In the last episode, we had the first part of my talk with Brian Bermudez. Brian is an aircraft maintenance technician who has worked at two major US airlines. He is now a professor of aviation maintenance and the director of airframe and power plant curriculum at Vaughan College of Aeronautics and Technology. He's also the president and founder of Craft of the Air, a multifaceted initiative encompassing aviation maintenance, consulting, and tutoring. Here's the second part of our chat. Now, one thing that I was surprised to first learn about is that an aircraft can actually fly with multiple things that don't work or that are quote-unquote deferred. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that a lot of people may not want to hear, but the aircraft is designed to fly with multiple systems, in most cases, inoperative. And the reason for this is, you know, again, going back to the beginning, that we have so many systems that are designed with backups and multiple layers of redundancy that the aircraft is capable of flying on sometimes with maybe just one system operative and two or three systems in op. Now, a deferral process is crucial, and it allows maintenance operations to defer maintenance tasks. And so, for instance, let's say we have an aircraft at John F. Kennedy Airport, and it's heading out to Seattle, to SeaTac. And let's say that this aircraft has a generator that's inoperative. And some people may say a generator, that has to be working for this airplane to depart. You know, the aircraft has two generators per engine. So we have four generators. And a deferral or MEL, minimum equipment list, is a document that is federally approved that allows us to, or it tells us, guidance on which systems can be inoperative and which systems have to be working. And in most cases, we'll have systems that can be functioning, but not every single component. So for instance, if we have a generator inoperative, a lot of times the deferral may say, for this aircraft to fly, to be airworthy, you only have to have two generators working. And so, it's kind of a process. It allows us to get to another base to perform maintenance. That's the main purpose of this. You know, a lot of times this plane needs to go. We have 230 passengers. And if it's not affecting the airworthiness or the safety of the aircraft, we can allow that aircraft to get to its next location and have the maintenance done there. And so, you know, this it's an interesting concept where the deferral process is essentially saying, well, we didn't fix it. We're going to go fix it somewhere else, but the aircraft is still as safe as it was before to fly.
Yeah, this is something that's really interesting when I first heard about it, because it's one of those things where you're like a plane, it's flying, you know, everything, absolutely, you know, you want everything to work. But like you said, there's a lot of redundancy built in, or you mentioned earlier too, sometimes whatever the issue is, it's, you know, it's purely aesthetic, or if there's one seat that's broken, you know, that's, you know, the rest of the plane can fly, right?
And if I add one more thing, Andrew, you know, building on that, when we speak about the redundancy, you know, a lot of people may not know this, but the ETOPS, extended twin operating procedures and standards, those are aircraft that are operating any distance where they're going to be over 45 minutes away from the closest airport. And these are airplanes in the United States that the FAA keeps to a higher maintenance standard. These airplanes must be able to operate on one single engine for a sustained period of time. A lot of times ETOPS planes are something that they're going to be operating over the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean. And so these planes are designed so that if one engine fails, it can still get to the closest, safest landing area safely on one engine. So a lot of people should feel confident in the aircraft's abilities.
And actually, yeah, that's a great point. And just for a bit of context for our listeners, ETOPS is the main reason that we see less and less four-engine aircraft and more two-engine aircraft, because there's additional maintenance and requirements in place for these aircraft to be able to operate on one engine. So occasionally I hear people who are like, oh, I feel safer on an aircraft with four engines. Well, A, those are sort of going out of fashion because of ETOPS, and B, yes, ETOPS is in place to address those safety concerns. And, you know, it's a highly regulated field, and that concern you know, is addressed through the whole ETOPS system, right?
That's a good point about, yeah, and that's very true. So true about the four engine. Yep.
Yeah. Now, moving on, one of the other things that you had sort of mentioned earlier that I want to touch on a little bit more is that, so aircraft have all sorts of, you know, parts inside them. I was going to try to quantify this question. I was going to say, oh, you know, thousands or tens of thousands, but honestly, I'm not sure. So many, right? I'm wondering how a maintenance department keeps track of all of them and ensures that the right ones are used in the right place and the right aircraft and all that.
There are quite literally millions of different parts and so many different systems on an aircraft. It's interesting because there's so many different parts and so many subsystems that our maintenance manuals, which is how we find out how to do tasks and how we make sure that we're doing the correct tasks on the aircraft. These maintenance manuals can be 20 to 30,000 pages easily. You know, they're broken up into something we speak of, ATA chapters. And this is kind of a universal way of this numbering system in aviation where, you know, a specific number means 32 is landing gears, 33 means lights. And so across the board, Airbuses, Boeings, Embraers, they have these maintenance manuals that engineers can follow, and we can look to see how to perform a task, what parts we need for a task, and what special tools we need for a task, and how to operationally check the system after we've completed maintenance on it. You know, these, as I said, you know, these maintenance manuals, they're very, very long. And thankfully for us, they're in digital versions now. A lot of these maintenance operations, they have tough books or iPads that the engineers can look up these references very quickly. But it's interesting because there's multiple manuals that these manufacturers, Boeing, Airbus, they have for us to use as tools. We have AMMs, aircraft maintenance manuals, that tell us the step-by-step directions on how to do everything from changing an engine, a $55 million engine, to a reading light above your seat. We also have IPCs, illustrated parts catalogs, that are tens of thousands of pages, and they have each individual nut, washer, I mean, you name it, wow, in these. And it has exploded views of all the parts. We have troubleshooting manuals. We have full isolation manuals. So all of these things help us to narrow in on the section that we need to work on or troubleshoot with. But I'll tell you what, Andrew, it does take quite some time when you're a new AMP and you're first getting acquainted to all these manuals. And as you said, just so many parts sometimes.
Yeah. And I can't imagine, like, if, you know, you're a new AMP and you're fresh out of school or whatnot, and you show up and there's all this content, parts, things like that. I mean, I can't even imagine where you start, right?
Yeah.
Kind of along the same lines, do you find that, like, let's say, you know, if you're working on actually any sort of aircraft, when do you find that there's the manufacturers, whether they do or not, and B, if so, how, like, publish ongoing guidance and updates and things like that to their manuals and parts, and how does that get conveyed?
So, you know, when we work for the major airlines, thankfully for us, we have good support systems. We have maintenance control for every major airline, and they'll usually update us on anything that's been revised within the manufacturer's maintenance manuals. But when what really comes to concern for maintenance personnel is when we have a revision such as an airworthiness directive, something that was changed due to an unsafe condition on board an aircraft. That's something that, you know, maintenance, FAA will hand down to maintenance control, and they'll send that to us to do. Airworthiness directives are important. You know, a lot of times the manufacturer will give us something like a service bulletin. And a service bulletin is a way for the manufacturer to kind of, it's called an SIAB now. And it's a way for the manufacturer, Boeing, Embraer, Airbus, for us to, you know, alert the aviation community on maybe an improvement on a certain system or a component, but it's not necessarily a requirement for us to change it. You know, it's only until we have revisions that are made and they're incorporated into an airworthiness directive. That's something that the FAA will say that, you know, that must be corrected. That aircraft, in certain cases, may not even be allowed to take off all the affected models until that problem is resolved. So we do try to keep a close eye on that for a lot of the AMPs that maybe work out there and work for general aviation, and they don't necessarily have maintenance control. The FAA, FAA.gov, they have just a very, I'm not just saying this to side with the FAA, they have such a helpful website on ways that we can locate service bulletins, any new informational tools, documents, anything related to the aircraft that we're working on or flying on. The FAA website is very helpful with those types of things. So that's something that we always keep an eye out for.
No, that's really interesting. And maybe again, for context, for our listeners, like, sort of on the extreme end of when there's an airworthiness directive is when we see, you know, groundings across the board of this aircraft can't fly, you know, the Dreamliner, the Mac, you know, I don't want to get into debating the legitimacy of the criticisms of the FAA, but you know, like, that from a consumer perspective, like, that's when we see those kinds of things happen on the extreme end, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's a perfect example. Dreamliner. And we could make another podcast about that, but yeah, the Dreamliner and the 37, perfect examples of that. Yeah.
Now, the last thing I kind of wanted to ask you before if we wrap up is to, because you're very passionate about your teaching and training and tutoring as well. So I was curious to hear a little bit about your perspective on what it takes to become an aircraft maintenance technician or engineers or AMP, all kind of interchangeable terms. But what does it take to get into that field?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Andrew. And it's funny that you asked that, because just getting through an open house here at the college and seeing some perspective AMPs possibly coming through and coming to college to study this, you know, a lot of people will say it's the mechanical aptitude side of things. But when you look at an AMP, you know, you can go to school. We can teach you here how to use a torque wrench and teach you here how to use the basics. I could teach you how to use a multimeter and troubleshoot for electricity. But when you think about it, it's really the multitasking. You know, an AMP, when you look at the nightly routine and what they deal with, an AMP is more times than not doing 3, 4, 5 different things at a time. And when I say that, you can be working on an airplane and you're looking at a schematic, you could be on the phone with maintenance control. You know, one of the first questions you ask, a gate call. You can be on a plane with 260 passengers, crying babies, flight attendants asking if they could continue boarding, the pilots asking what's going on. And an AMP has to stay composed and still be able to keep their eye on what the fault is, what that problem is. And they have to be able to reason and problem solve very quickly, and they have to be confident. There's a lot of things that makes a good AMP, but when it comes down to it, I always tell my students, be confident and be able to do more than one thing at a time. If you can't do that now, start get used to doing more than one thing at a time, because a lot of times that's what it takes. And another thing, AMPs work 99% of the time. AMPs are working in the evening, overnight hours. They're working outside in the elements. And a lot of times, you know, one of the first things we tell students is, are you prepared to miss holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Christmas Eves? Are you prepared to sleep during the day while the whole world is working? And you're out there at night, you know, now you're working. You know, these are the types of things that makes a good AMP. I guess if I had to sum it up, adaptability is probably the key there in being a successful aircraft maintenance engineer.
Yeah, that's actually a good point that I imagine some people maybe don't think of. It's one of those, among many airline jobs or jobs in the aviation industry, where it is truly 24/7, 365, right? It's a world where, you know, especially in the commercial space, where it never goes to sleep, right?
Yeah. So true.
One more career related question, in terms of career trajectory, is it kind of like, you know, for example, in the pilot world, it's, you know, a lot of people, the end goal is to work for a major airline, but is that sort of the same case in the AMP world, or, you know, or because there's all sorts of different, aircraft types you can work on, right? From general aviation to commercial airliners, or like other commercial fields, like helicopters and things like that. Is there sort of a standard career trajectory or standard goals, or is just sort of everyone kind of specializing their own interests?
I love this question, Andrew, for so many reasons. I've tried asking so many of my own guests that are AMPs in the past where they like to see themselves. And I think of myself where I like to see myself. You know, a lot of AMPs, when you think about line maintenance and working in a hangar environment, the highest that you're going to reach for that airline is a base manager or supervisor. And, you know, don't get me wrong, that's a great job, great salary, great benefits. But that's probably where you're going to see yourself topping out with a major airline. You know, you get the flight benefits, you have pension and all that stuff. But a lot of AMPs look for other things. You know, it's very rare that you see an AMP that has only one job, because your AMP licenses encompass so many different fields of maintenance and engineering that AMPs just find other things to do. And a lot of times, you know, AMPs work maybe 3 or 4 days a week, you know, 12-hour shifts. So they're off for a couple of days. A lot of AMPs, I would say, Andrew, would like to see themselves owning small shops and being their own bosses. You know, every AMP that you speak to would like to one day have their own little small operation and working on their own planes. But you have, you know, a lot of people that explore the other routes of A&Ps where they'll eventually own a company or do something, as I said, that maybe their license covers. You know, an A&P is somebody that's federally licensed in electricity, hydraulics, fire protection, every system known to mankind. So a lot of A&Ps find their niches in little mechanical fields throughout the way. In aviation, I think the best thing for us to reach as an A&P in maintenance in the airline is to manage a hub and to do it successfully.
Brian Bermudez is an aircraft maintenance engineer and a professor of aviation maintenance. Having worked for two major U.S. airlines as an aircraft maintenance technician, he now teaches aviation maintenance and runs Craft of the Air, an aviation maintenance initiative involving multiple aspects like consulting and tutoring. Brian also hosts the CODACast, an aviation podcast where he explores various facets of maintenance and brings his experiences and knowledge to listeners who share his enthusiasm for this field. You can learn more about Brian, his work, and his podcast at craftoftheair.com and on social media. And of course, we'll have links to all that in the episode description. Well, Brian, thanks so much for coming to join me to explore this new area for the podcast and for coming to share your experience. I really appreciate you taking the time.
I really appreciate the time, Andrew, and I really appreciate the Flying Smarter podcast. It's something great. I thank the listeners from the Flying Smarter podcast, and Andrew, thank you so much again. I really enjoyed our time.
If you're enjoying Flying Smarter, please take a minute to leave a 5-star review for the show if you're listening on a podcast that allows you to do so, like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps grow the podcast as well as convince prospective listeners and guests, and I would really appreciate your help. That brings us to the end of episode 57 of Flying Smarter. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.